And we are back. Thank you for joining us for another edition of the Daily Dots. And joined almost as always by the Brain Trust, Mr. Chase Taylor. Not a lot of fireworks today. Give us a rundown. Where would you finish on the indexes?
Pretty much dead flat on S&P and the Qs. Small caps are up about 0.5%. So were Magnificent 7 up 0.43. Volatility got smacked down about 5% on spot VIX. Other than that, dollar down 0.13. To me, the only really notable move today was on two and five year bond yields. Both of those kind of broke out to the upside. Only up 4 and 3 basis points, but you look at a chart and it's like a level that they kept struggling to get above for weeks, and all of a sudden, boom, above it. So that was notable. 10, 20, 30 years were pretty flat. Oil down about 0.5%, gold up 0.5%.
Man, gold is being resilient.
Every time it gets hit, it kind of like beach balls back up.
Yeah, it was down. I want to say it was down a good 80 or 90 bips overnight. I checked it before I went to bed.
Every time I checked gold and silver, they were like just way different, like all day.
Yeah, and then I got up this morning, got up this morning and looked at them, and I went, oh boy, they're right back at it. What else do we have for news going around right now? It's pretty quiet, isn't it?
Yeah, today we just had one little release from the New York Fed for like consumer stuff and inflation, and it was completely, it's just all kind of like what you would expect. Nothing major. So nothing to really speak of on the data side. One other thing I'll say, just from price action today, NVIDIA down 1%. So it's kind of like right at this, kind of like 866 area, which, if it breaks below that, especially if it breaks a good bit below that, like on the chart at least, looks kind of troublesome. So that's one to watch for sure moving forward, because as we all know, that's kind of been, you know, the stock and sort of the driver of a bunch of other stocks. So if that were to kind of break below, say, 850, I would think it would take a lot of stuff with it.
Yeah, it's been weird for a long time. It just feels like it's getting weirder and weirder and weirder. I'm still trying to. I found myself over the weekend laughing about the fact that, 3 weeks ago we'd made sufficient progress against inflation to cut rates, and now people are talking about the potential of hikes.
Right.
And I was thinking about flying back and forth to Austin. Obviously, I had some time to think on my hands, and I just thought that. If you want to know why guys like us are fed up, pardon the pun, with the Fed, and not just in a way where we're constantly bashing them, but fed up, just to be that wrong in the space of 2.5 weeks, I kind of feel like that tells you, like, not that they're dishonest, not that they're trying to, but it just seems ridiculous that we're being led by these people that in that short of period of time could be that wrong. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, I think they're trying to turn the super tanker around slow, but I think now that they got it half turned around, they got to like flip the bow thrusters and start trying to get back the other way. I think on net though, they're still talking about like, oh, we still think we'll be able to cut later this year. Like that's still like, I would argue the consensus. But I think what they're starting to do is say like, but we've, you know, kind of noticed some shaky stuff that makes us think there's upside risk to inflation. So, hey, you never know. Maybe we'll just have to hike. Probably not. Don't worry about it. But maybe. I think they're starting to try to cover that base because it, you know, when A, the inflation data starts picking back up, and B, like the all the growth and labor data just refuses to weaken, like it starts to make their base case look really wrong.
There's still a lot of weird data things going on too. And like we've talked about, I don't know. It feels hard for me not to assume that it has to do with the anomalies that we're seeing in soft data for a lot of the different reasons that we've discussed, right? That a lot of the soft data indicators are more manufacturing heavy and are maybe not great, great. What would you call that?
Proxies. For
yeah. Right.
It's whole economy.
Exactly. Certainly less, efficient. That's not the right word, but certainly less emblematic of the overall economy than they were, let's say, 20 or 30 years ago, right? But it is odd to see such quote-unquote strong housing numbers and then to see household surveys be so weak in the face of that as it relates to labor. Is there anything outside, anything in addition to that that might be, I don't know, you know, manipulating or making those numbers look different than they were? Or do you think this is just as simple as we were saying? It's more about the soft data not meaning what it used to anymore.
I think it's the latter mostly. If you meant household survey for the employment data, like that one finally like ripped back. If you meant like consumer like sentiment type stuff, well, that stuff's up a good bit, but still, I would say like if you look back historically, fairly weak. And I think that we've kind of talked about it before with like price level being still so high. Sure, like the rate of change on inflation's chilled out, but like, you know, everyone knows how much things cost at the store and it's still high. And I think people, that's a slow adjustment for people to make. I heard a great thing on a podcast the other day. I was talking about how one of the reasons I think consumer like sentiment is bad is they attribute their wage gains to them being good at their job, and they attribute prices going up at the store to like something outside of them, right? So like if your wages keep up with inflation, even if it was a perfect net out for your wages and inflation, you would still feel bad about it because you would feel like you earned the one and the other one was like just against you, right?
Yeah.
And I think there's some truth to that. So I think that's part of it. Like, hey, stuff's more expensive and that makes people upset. You know, and if you're under 40 and you, especially if you don't own a house yet, like, you're not going to feel good about stuff. You know what I mean?
Well, no, that, and then I don't know if you feel the same way, but I am just exhausted by the ridiculous comments regarding inflation and the way it works. I do not understand why otherwise seemingly serious people have such a hard time understanding that because the inflation rate is down to 3 or whatever they're saying it is, doesn't mean like they're trying to, they put that up there and then they try to make it sound like that's better than it was in 2019 before this started. You know, no guys, it's a rate of change. Okay. Nothing is even close to as cheap as it was prior to COVID. It's a ridiculous statement.
It's never going to be.
No. I mean, that ship sailed, right? Mm-hmm. Like, for instance, you can hold your breath all you want waiting till when McDonald's is going to sell its double cheeseburger for $1.99 again.
This stuff makes me feel like an old timer. I remember like getting annoyed by my dad and my grandpa talking about how much this and that used to cost, and now I find myself doing it.
Oh, yeah.
It's like a rite of passage, I guess. But
well, yeah, but your dad and grandfather, it didn't happen over a 4-year span either.
Yeah.
Well, in the 70s, that's not true.
Yeah, they ate it a lot worse than we did in the 70s, at least. But
yeah, well,
this is one of those tired things. You just don't want to hear, like, you go to the barbershop and everyone's talking about how much this and that used to cost. You're just like, shut up.
No.
And now that, you know, now that I'm 40, I'm like, back in my day, you know?
Yeah, it just is kind of shocking, though, when you take your family of 5 through McDonald's, you know, drive through.
Or God forbid, Disney World.
There next week.
I just bought the pictures that they took of us while we were at Disney. If you want all of them, $210. And this is just, you know, some people just standing there taking your pictures. If you want just the one day's worth, $75. And if you want to just pick one picture out, it was like $17.95.
Unbelievable. I was laughing. My buddy, so we've never done Disney with the kids. So we're doing it. We leave this Saturday.
Awesome. Yep.
So we're going to have to work out dots. I'm going to be working. We're going to have to work out dots for next week. I'm sure you guys listening to the dots would love to hear us do that right on the show here. that'd be entertaining.
Get the calendars out.
Yeah. My buddy was sending me a picture. He was down with his kids at Disneyland this last week. And there was a dad walking around with a Disney shirt on it, but on the back of it, it said most expensive day ever.
So I saw like 3 or 4 guys wearing those at the park. And I was like, I need that.
I was dying laughing. I was like, I want to get like 4 of those.
Yeah.
Just so every day I walk through the park, you know, I'm making my, I don't really know what statement it is. It feels like a protestation of sorts. Right. I don't know if you had those thoughts when you were down there, but you're looking around and you know what average incomes are and all that other kind of stuff. And you're looking at how expensive all this is. And it's really not like a, when I'm not like this, I know you're certainly not like this. It's not a classist thing. You're not looking down your nose at people, but you're, you know, sitting there going, this is outrageously expensive.
Yeah.
I know what normal people make.
Yeah.
How in the world are they affording this?
Yeah. It's like kind of frustrating and sad, honestly.
Yeah.
Because like I say, like we, I mean, work in finance. We're fortunate enough to just make too much money. And like, it wasn't like a, there are things that cost a reasonable amount and I can shrug it off. Cause like I've been blessed in life and that, but the Disney wasn't one of those things I could shrug off. It was like, I feel this, like,
yeah.
So like, you know, if I am a family, if I have a family of four and I'm making 70 grand, like I, you would feel that in a really significant way. It would be debt or it would be saving up for 3 years or something. Like it would be hardcore. So I personally find it really frustrating that something that's to me is sort of like American rite of passage is to go to, you know, theme parks, especially Disney, that it's that hard for working class people to go. It's just not right to me.
What's
just start a charity to like subsidize regular people's ability to go there. But then again, they would just get all the ill-gotten gains there.
I was going to say, Bob Iger would be a big fan of that.
Yeah, he would.
Yeah. He might nominate you to the board after that. No, but then the other part of me sits there and wonders, there's going to be a pushback at some point. And Disney in particular, I'm not going to try to go off on Disney here because
it's not like it's just them. Right.
Yeah. Now. But I mean, they're just,
all they're doing is responding to supply and demand and like, hey, why not? Right.
Yeah. But I mean, I know, but it's not really what they're supposed to be about. Right. They're supposed to be the American family. They are hosing consumers. I mean, they're hosing them.
You have to be like wildly strategic if you want to get in there without spending a bunch of money. Like, don't stay at the park. B, like bring your own food. Like you would have to like really plan it out.
Yeah, and they're very good at papering over those holes in the fence. I mean, you know, as far as keeping you from being able to do that.
Sure.
You know, like I am not a wait in line guy. I'm just not.
I'll give them credit for that. So yes, they will take your money right to skip. But now, like, so it used to be a thing where you could just pay a whole bunch of money and you could just skip all the lines. Not anymore. Like, you get to do it like 2 or 3 times a day and that's it. Like, so yeah. They like kind of throttle it, which I think that was, you know, they got enough complaints from people to be like, look, this is BS. Like, just because I can't afford it.
There's another one. So you're talking about the fast passes.
Right.
They still have one called the VIP that's up another level.
Oh, I never saw that.
Yeah, that is expensive and you get unlimited. You go in front of the line every
single time. So the only one I saw was the lightning lane or whatever. And it was
lightning.
Like,
yep.
You get to do it like 2 or 3 times only.
Yeah. Yep. And at certain times, like there's stuff. And I'm not going to gripe about those prices because obviously you can opt in, you can opt out, but man, it's just a hose job. And you look around and you just wonder how the average American family is swinging this. I mean, it's just,
you could always get like the grandparents to pay for it because the boomers got all the money.
That's true. That's where you start guilting them in. That's where you go over to your parents' house. You go, okay, so what are we getting the kids for Christmas?
Yeah, I can't hear you over that Medicare you're getting from that I'm paying for. So how about you pay for the kids to go to Disney?
Yeah, that $3,800 of Social Security, huh? That's literally coming out of my paycheck.
Yeah, and all the 401k money that I put in that is inflating your portfolio.
Yeah. What about any other interesting things you saw over the weekend? Any things that you noticed or any things you were – I went to a very interesting dinner on Friday night with
– That's going to be more interesting than anything I got.
Oh, yeah. A lot of discussion about the same old stuff, though. I think that we were all in agreement that – which kind of makes me nervous about it. But I think everybody was in agreement that it very much does feel like the tides have turned, that we're in a new phase of the market and the economy. It does very much feel like the inflation, you know, genie is certainly out of the bottle. It feels to me like markets are sniffing out the predicament that governments and central banks, just not just here, but around the world are in, meaning you've got a debt overhang that absolutely, now they're not going to come out and say this, but it absolutely limits what they can do with rates, right? They have constraints that they did not have in the 1970s as far as interest rate policy goes.
Right.
Right. You can see that in deficits. You can see that in debt overhang. I mean, it's obvious.
And the big political constraint, because no one's willing to go there.
No.
You won't get reelected.
No. And so now you're running $2.5 trillion deficits. And I mean, you guys can sit around with your, you know, holding your breath, waiting for them to balance a budget. That ain't going to happen. We'll never see it happen again in our lifetimes. As a matter of fact, I think it's just going to, you know, it's just going to keep stretching out more and more and more and more. You know, I don't know if you've ever sat down and done the math it would take to try to figure out how you could balance the budget someday.
Yeah, I mean, the bottom line is it takes major reform on entitlements. Major.
Yeah. Yeah.
Giant haircuts.
Yeah. And that's the problem is that you can just see the ramp on where the spending's going.
I will say, though, there becomes a point where all the beneficiaries of that, you know, call it just Medicare or Social Security, become smaller and smaller. And then the voting cohort paying for it, millennials, Gen Z, become huge. You get to a point where politically, all the payers are like, let's vote to stop paying, you know, this little bit of takers that are left.
Yeah.
So I think we could get very real entitlement reform, but, you know, 15, 20 years from now, not in the next 5 years, which yeah. from a market practitioner perspective, like who cares about the fact that it might happen in 15 years? But I do think just the numbers suggest at some point when millennials are running the whole government instead of, you know, 90-year-olds, you might get a point where like, they're like, yeah, no, you guys don't get that anymore.
Yeah.
Or, heavily means test it, things like that.
Yeah. It was interesting talking to Lacey Hunt or Dr. Lacey Hunt, I guess. And I was going to explain to listeners who that is, right? But longtime money manager, but also worked in,
he worked at the Fed for years, Fed, PhD yeah. economist.
Yeah.
Very, very smart. Been right about bonds my entire life.
Yeah.
Until the last 3 years.
Yeah. He got the short right. I mean, he was saying to buy bonds because he thought.
I don't think he's ever really changed his tune to this point. I think he still thinks everyone's going to do the right thing and that bond prices will, or bond yields will continue to go down because of all the big secular forces. Those secular forces have changed. I don't think he sees it that way.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
If I was right about something for 40 years in a row, I don't think I'd ever change my mind either.
Yeah, that's true. That's pretty good track record, pretty good run of success. But no, it was just interesting to listen to all those guys talking. It was a very eclectic group. You had guys that had made some really big money, serious money in crypto. Lacey Hunt was there. Our friend Jason Polansky was there. just a good, smart group of guys. And, you know, just it's reassuring, if nothing else. I wish that we could videotape something like that in such a way that nobody knew they were being videotaped. Because I think if the average listener saw how a group of seasoned financial professionals were really talking about things, I think the average person would be more concerned than they are. You know, I don't think that, I think it's so easy to get on. I think we're so much more exposed to and used to doom porn, for lack of a better term, that it's just so easy to write off anything that sounds like an existential threat, right? As drama or as doom porn, if you will. And I just don't think people have a real realization of how far, like we're not talking about this being a problem 20 or 30 years from now, right? We're staring it in the whites of its eyes right now.
Right.
Right. And some really fascinating, I think historic and hard choices are going to be need to be made in the not too distant future. Right. Because one of my thoughts is, first of all, You and I were teasing this out earlier. We didn't really get a chance to go over it in greater detail. But one of the things that I was thinking about again over the weekend was, what kind of event would you have to have? And I'm saying this because I've done obviously an about face on this over the last year and a half, just looking at what, you know, the things that accompanied the Fed getting tough. You know, like I think when you and I, like if you took us back to 2019, you're like, look, they're going to go on this rate hiking cycle and all that. We'd have been like, this whole thing's going to blow up.
Yeah. Right? I mean, it was a lot of people's opinion. I thought if they push rates past 3, it was going to get crazy.
Yeah. Well, we just didn't know that they were going to be pushing capital into the market at the same time.
Yeah. That, and I do think the neutral rate is significantly higher than it was going into that rate hiking cycle. So it allows for a lot more leeway.
Well, you know who's singing that story right now? Is Larry Summers.
Yeah, and he's dead, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And I made that point in my letter this weekend. Like, he's one of the few people who got inflation right going in.
Yeah, he did.
And now he's saying, like, hey, the neutral rate's high, and you got, I don't know why in the world they're talking about cutting. Like, I don't know why people don't take that kind of stuff more seriously. But notably, and I talked about this in the Friday dots, I think, but going into the week, only one person on the Fed that I know of, and I may have missed something, but especially from all the published speeches on the Fed's website, only Kashkari had even mentioned the fact that the neutral rate might be higher. And then last week, three of them talked about it, two of them on Friday. So that tells me, like, okay, they're starting to get it. Now, in the same week, Powell again kind of pushed back on it and basically said, like, I don't care, we don't make policy with that anyway. But to me, like, you it's time to reflect on that, because you might need to make policy on it. Because
what does he make policy on?
At the end of the – well, to his point, like, it's not observable. It's too slow moving. Like, there's no point in trying to
– I get what he's saying. Right. But I just think it's funny what he uses to make policy one meeting.
Yeah, what is it, though? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, like, you've said it 100 times. I mean, that guy is shuffling goalposts like nobody I've ever seen.
To me, it's clear the neutral rate is – so what Larry Summers said, he thinks it's above 4, and I totally agree. I mean, rates are 5.5, and nothing's slowed down.
If you have full employment – with 5.5% funds rate, how in the world can you make the argument that the neutral rate is?
And we're like 9 months after the last hike, so it's been stuck at 5.5 for like 9 months, and we just had a blockbuster jobs report.
Yeah, I don't even understand how you make the argument.
Right.
I mean, and it's not like it's close. 350 basis points, a pretty wide delta.
Yeah, right. That was a lot of hikes.
I don't.
And like, the economy's. Clearly, a lot of the economy, at least, is reaccelerating, like, full stop.
Yeah. Now, I think that, like, to point out, like, the conversation, like, if you guys ever think that Chase and I will disagree on things all the time, but if you guys think that we're in disagreement on this, we're not. When you hear me banging on the economy, what I'm saying is that, yes, it is unquestionably strong. To say that the economy isn't strong right now would be a mischaracterization of the data. It is strong. And if you're one of those people out there, oh, it's not. It is. It is strong. Okay. But the question that I always go back to is why? Well, show me an economy that isn't some backwater third world economy. When you're running 6.5 to 7% deficits, and this was the question I was going to get into. If you think about that, and then you think about the trajectory of spending, meaning, you know, government spending is going up next year too. Okay. When you're running deficits like that, what kind of, I mean, it would take a massive event to create a recession. It would just create.
I think the biggest thing would be it requires asset prices going down. Like,
yeah.
I still think that's the thing the Fed's missing. Like, yeah, do I think the neutral rate's higher than they think? Yes.
Yep.
But would it, like, I think if all of a sudden asset prices went down, all of a sudden the neutral rate would feel lower. Like, because I think all the data would follow it. Just like it has for the last two quarters. Like, that's why maybe we just got lucky, and it has nothing to do with it, but that's why I think we got the last two quarters right, is because we just looked at asset prices and went, oh, okay, well, that's going to make the economy hot. So I think if asset prices went down for whatever reason, you would get the opposite. That might be the single, now getting asset prices to go down with a 6% budget deficit, not easy either, but I think that's the single biggest threat to the economy now. I mean, we've talked a million times about construction, like, I think that's the biggest thing to watch cyclically. But at the end of the day, like, it's asset prices. And it has become a feedback loop between asset prices and the economy. And it's feeding on itself in a very positive way right now.
Yeah, and obviously that's the most pronounced with the baby boomers, but you only need to spend a little bit of time on social media to realize there's a lot of people out there that are partly financing their life with trading in some kind of way, Bitcoin, crypto, right? All of these things. And all of those things, you know, for instance, look at the economic readings you're getting right now. The whole crypto sphere was worth what? 1/5 of what it is today, 12, 14 months ago?
That sounds about right, yeah.
Probably like 1/5. Well, that difference between 1/5 and where it's at today is more than $1 trillion.
Speaking of, did you see the dog with hat party?
No.
Oh, there's like a big bash for the dog with hat people.
I mean, that's like my patron saint of crypto, man. Dog with hat. Is that thing still going up?
I don't know.
Yeah, I that's.
I'll get our whiff analyst on it.
Yeah, yeah. Talk with that. Oh man, you know they're dragging the bottom of the bio. Or the,
we're going to hire a dog coin analyst soon.
Yes, yes. And I wonder what the correlation between that and Dogecoin is.
Probably pretty high.
Dogs are pretty big in crypto space these days.
It's true. There's a lot of them.
It's a big deal.
If you were just long the dogs, you'd probably crush everything this year.
Oh man, you could
especially,
have.
Especially if you throw in sound out.
Oh yeah.
Not that wrong.
Yeah.
We let the dogs out. That's the story of 2024.
Yeah, what is the hound doing?
I think the Chinese calendar is wrong. It's not the year of the dragon. It's clearly the year of the dog.
100%. What is the hound doing? Did it?
I have no clue.
We used that thing like a rented mule. Just gave a little ride on it, got out of there, took our cash, and that was the equivalent of a stock smash and grab job.
Oh yeah, it got up to like 10. Now it's 5. So it's been cut in half from the peak.
Didn't we get out of there like 8? Something like that. 8, 7, 750, somewhere in there.
I don't remember.
Yeah. Well,
we did well. We got out relatively close to the top, I think.
Yeah, relatively. We're not going to.
Can't get them all wrong.
No. Yeah, you're bound to get a few right here and there. Trying to think of anything else we need to cover. What is on the horizon? What should we be looking at?
The big thing is Wednesday. So we have a small business survey tomorrow, but then Wednesday's CPI, and then Thursday will be PPI. So getting the inflation prints Wednesday, Thursday will be.
Oh, here's one I saw over the weekend. I haven't read into this. I think I just caught a blurb about it this morning. But Biden's ready to roll out a debt payoff plan for 30 million people.
Yes, yeah, more. don't ever let the Supreme Court slow you down. Like some more student debt relief. I haven't read anything on it. I don't know anything. But
hey,
other than he's going to take another swing at it.
This is why, and I'll make a commitment right here. If this does happen, I will give an equivalent amount to charity. I will. But this is why I've not let my wife pay off the one last student loan that we have.
I think a lot of people are doing that.
It's one of the smallest ones. It's not a significant amount of money to us. But you know, I was going through the whole home buying purchase, you know, process. And that subject came up once or twice. They were like, why do you just have this one loan? Because it's like all I've got. I don't have debt. I've got my American Express card. I pay it off.
Because Uncle Joe might pay for it.
Yeah. And I just said, there's no way I'm paying this until I know that there's no chance that I get it paid for. Because then I was sitting there thinking, man, if he does it for 30 million people, you couldn't do that with means testing. I mean, how many million people in the country have student debt?
I have no clue.
It's probably not much more than 30 million people.
Yeah, I mean, that's 10% of the population.
10% of the entire population.
Right, and not that. Yeah, it can't be. That's got to be a lot.
Oh, what is it, like less than 20%, I think, go to college?
I mean, go to some college is probably a lot higher than that. Finish, different story.
Okay. Yeah, I just – I mean, the Oprah dynamic of this economy and this government, it just won't stop. I mean, it's just you get a car. We just keep throwing it out there, which is another form of fiscal policy.
Yeah, 100%.
Right. And I think that – I think a lot of people – there was a lot of weird consternation about people saying that fiscal policy was here to stay. I was a little more on the fence about it, but the one thing I did think about is if you pull the fiscal lever in the middle of a crisis, then you're basically baking that into crisis response going forward, right? Like meaning if you just think about the way, like how often do politicians do what they should and what's responsible, right? As opposed to how many politicians sit there and look at everything as an opportunity. Everything is an opportunity to get more votes. And now that you've taken the cellophane, if you will, off the top of the fiscal, you know, bowl, I just think now the one thing I did not think about was things like this, right? A sweeping wide government wide payoff of student loans, but that's fiscal. I mean, that's 100% fiscal stimulus.
Yes.
So now one other thing I want to talk to you about. I watched a TikTok over the weekend. I don't even have TikTok. I don't think I've ever been on it.
But someone sent you a link or something. Yeah, you can just watch it.
Yeah, I was on Twitter. Yeah, I ran into it. And it was this girl. And I thought that I should talk about this for our listeners as well, because it just sounded really dicey. She said that she was making extra money giving her credit card information to this third party that basically teams you up with people that have bad credit, and you make them an authorized user on your credit card, but they're not given any of the access or the information, so they can't charge anything. But what it does is it makes your credit history part of their credit history on their credit report, and it instantly pushes their credit rating up.
So basically credit card
fraud.
Yeah, like at least credit rating fraud.
Right. I was sitting there going, this has to be against the law in some way, shape, or form. But then I also was just thinking about our clients and our, you know, listeners to our show. And look, when you have people that are struggling as much to meet bills, guys, the fraud out there is going through the roof. Okay. Be really careful. Don't, you know, and like I've told all of our clients, if you see anything like that that sounds even modestly attractive, call us. Okay. And there's so many scams. There's so many scams that we've been able to prevent for our clients. But they're getting more elaborate and they're getting trickier and they're getting more convincing, you know, and you're also going to hear stories almost universally of people that you know and trust where it worked for them. That's all part of the deal, right? You gotta feed some ducks
up front. Yep.
Yeah. You gotta set the hook. So just be extra careful about guys. That one was a whole new level that I'd never even heard of. You're giving credit card data to a third party person who's, that can't be legal.
And if it is, like, that's the kind of thing Congress should be taking care of. Like, instantly be like, oh, we left a gap in there, so like we have to fix that.
Yeah.
Or, you know, the regulatory people should fix that.
That has to be some type of misrepresentation or fraud. It has to be.
It's a credit score laundering.
Yeah. Which, I mean, that.
And no one has a bigger, you know, incentive to make sure that doesn't happen than the actual credit folks, because then they're going to be lending money to people they shouldn't because of that.
Yeah. Which, I mean, this is always the case with new technology, but then it just kind of sent my mind. Again, you have a lot of time sitting on airplanes, so you kind of let your mind wander. But you start realizing, like, there are so many different Pandora's boxes being opened now, right? I mean, if you look at AI, you look at crypto, you look at all these different things, it's just a ripe opportunity, I think, to get defrauded or to get tricked. And then also you've got that natural thing, right, where government struggles on with how to manage or how to regulate new technology. I think that's going to be a big thing going forward as well.
100%.
We're already seeing it in the crypto space, right? Like what to even call crypto? Is it a security? Is it this? Is it that?
Yeah, and the regulatory framework is moving along at the speed of smell when it comes to all that stuff in the U.S.
Yeah, why do you think that is?
Regulatory capture, biggest thing probably, and it's just the agencies are so slow, poorly staffed, too much bureaucracy, too much red tape within them to allow them to do any sort of agile, you know, regulations of anything.
Yeah, and crypto, to be fair to the regulators though, crypto is a,
yeah, that's like genuinely new and difficult to figure out.
Yeah, if you put that on my desk as a regulator,
same with AI. Like AI is really tough to figure out, like how.
Yeah, yeah.
And all the cries for more regulation tend to come from the current power players that want to just ring fence, you know, build a fence around themselves. So like it's just sketchy. And yeah. What's annoying is so often the big boys end up doing the regulations. They end up basically writing it. And naturally into their own favor.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's why it's anytime you hear a Wall Street bank calling for more regulation, I wouldn't say it's 100%, but it's close, yep. Right? You've got to be looking over your shoulder going, what do they have to gain from this? And it's almost all regulatory capture.
Yep.
And
they get harder to, you know, barriers to entry and stuff for new people. So you have less competition and all that kind of stuff.
And I think that at no other time, I mean, look, I've never had a big esteem for those in public office, but I think that, you know, I have to believe that the quality of people that we have in public office right now is also making it a tougher issue.
Yeah. I mean, no one grows up wanting to really go, you know, serve as a bureaucrat or like a, you know, mid-level regulatory agency worker. Everyone wants to do something, worthy of TikTok.
Well, and our politicians don't have a good handle on this stuff too either. I mean,
no, I mean, it's like the guy that the one old senator in the hearing, like what's a Substack? Like, okay, this is who's regulating things. Like,
is that a spinoff of Subway? Do they do good sandwiches there? The other one, that this is just a social observance from me. And please, when I say this, do not read into it politically. But I just thought it was an excellent analog for what a tough place we're in politically right now. So once again, a lot of time to scroll Twitter. And I just don't have that time anymore. I used to be on Twitter a lot more for research reasons during the, sure, you know, but as the firm's grown and more phone calls and more meetings and all stuff like that. But I was going through Twitter and I was reading through a thread. People were commenting on the earthquake of 2024 that rocked the Eastern Seaboard, right? 4.9, I think is what it was. And just so you know, you may not know this, I survived a six pointer.
That's big.
Yeah, I was actually on a ladder coming down off of a roof during a construction job in college. And we had an earthquake around here where you could absolutely feel it. It felt like you're like surfing the ground.
Yeah. You know, I lived in California for a decade.
Oh, that's so right. There. You felt. Yeah. Yeah. You felt. What was the biggest one you went through?
I don't know. I think it was upper fives.
But it was right underneath you too. It was probably just the San Andreas.
Yeah. So we lived 15, 20 miles from San Andreas, the actual line.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, you were front.
It was sketchy. It doesn't feel right.
No, it is a creepy feeling. The other thing about it is it lasts way longer than people like lead you to believe.
True.
Like I remember halfway through it, I was like, this is still going. Anyway, but I was sitting there thinking that if this isn't a perfect analog for what a tough spot we're in politically. So I don't even remember the names. Somebody that is generally seen as being on the far left was like, this was a terrifying experience, and this should be the conclusive proof that climate change is real.
Are you serious about an earthquake?
Yep. Yep. Then on the flip side of it, it was somebody on the far right saying that this is the beginning of God's scourge against us for our sinful sinful nature.
Perfect encapsulation of 2024 in America.
And obviously, my faith is a big, important part to me. Like, you know, and I'm never going to dog on somebody for that. But when somebody starts characterizing a 4.9% or 4.9, you know, earthquake, magnitude earthquake as God's punishment, I'm just like, or it's a couple tectonic plates shifting.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe that's what happened.
Or it was physics, guys.
Yeah. Or it was just physics. But on one end, it's God's judgment. On the other end. And I just.
It's the other end is also God's judgment. Just a different God.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. You're right. It's just. Yeah. Right. That's right. Yeah, it's just dogma from a different church. Anyway, and again, like you guys, that's not me bashing on anybody. Obviously, my faith is probably the most important part of my life, and at the center of who I am and what I do. At the same time, I think miscategorizing things like that, I think it's wrong. I think it's wrong. And it also, like I said, I think the scariest part about it is if that does not illuminate the gap in the issue that we've got. I mean, these people are in elected office.
Yeah, you get a little quake in New Jersey, and your first thought is, how can I score a political point against the other tribe on this?
Yeah, yeah. And it just – and both tribes are all too willing to pick up those weapons and go back to war. You know what I mean? So anyway, all right, well, that's about it. Went a little over. Anything else you have for us that we want to get to?
Nope, that's good.
We don't really have anything else on the docket except what you're talking about coming up Wednesday.
Wednesday, Thursday would be the big ones with inflation.
All righty, kids. Well, we will see you tomorrow. I hope you continue to take this journey with us. Oh, we're trying to get that Jared Dillian podcast back on that I was trying to get that scheduled again. I'm sorry to leave you guys hanging on that one. I had a wonderful flying experience. Got onto my plane on Thursday, and everything seemed to be going normal. We sit on the tarmac for an hour, miss our connection, get rerouted. What should have been a 3.5-4 hour flight ended up taking like 9 hours. Lost our bags in the process. It had my mic, my portable studio that I was going to do that. So anyway, we're trying to get that dialed back in. So we will be back with another great interview this week, hoping it's Jared. If not, we've got a couple other folks that we want to fill in there as well. So stay tuned. Should have some good content coming out pretty quick. But anyway, until then, thank you for listening. Make sure you join us again tomorrow for another Daily Dots. And we'll see you then. This, you're listening to the Know Your Risk Radio podcast. Download and subscribe at knowyourriskradio.com.
The opinions expressed in this program are for general informational purposes only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual or on any specific security. It is only intended to provide education about the financial industry. To determine which investments may be appropriate for you, consult your financial advisor prior to investing. Any past performance discussed during this program is no guarantee of future results. Any indices referenced for comparison are unmanaged and cannot be invested into directly. As always, please remember investing involves risk and possible loss of principal capital. Please seek advice from a licensed professional. Investment advice cannot be given without a client service agreement. Bulwark Capital Management is an investment advisor representative of Trek Financial, LLC, an SEC registered investment advisor.